picture this. You're on a plane. The guy next to you pulls out a super nice professional-grade camera and begins taking photos out the window. Do you ask him what he's doing? Could be risky. You don't want to be that passenger. Then again, maybe he's an artist or a researcher. Maybe he has an interesting story and is dying for someone to ask him about it. You don't know. The plane lands. You disembark. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on Central Standard, we'll discuss a growing body of evidence suggesting that interacting with strangers makes us happier. But do we design our communities to encourage or discourage this interaction? Grab a stranger and invite them to listen. It could be the best thing you do all day. That's coming up right after this news. A recent article in the New York Times summed up a handful of studies suggesting that talking to strangers has measurable psychological benefits. The article has gone viral, but most of the scenes referenced in the article play out in crowded subways. It got us thinking about whether strangers brush up against one another often enough in Kansas City to have these beneficial interactions. As we isolate ourselves in our cars and on our phones, though preferably not at the same time, are we missing out on something right in front of us? I'm Gina Kaufman, and you're listening to Central Standard. Here to talk with us about strangers are a couple of guests. First, allow me to introduce Daniel Serta. He's a city planner and the founder of Insight, a planning and development consulting firm. Hi, Daniel.
Good morning.
So how can a city's design, and we're talking any city right now, not necessarily just Kansas City, how can the very structure of a city bring us into contact with strangers in our day-to-day lives?
Well, a city is defined really by the opportunity to engage with strangers. If you think about a small town, most people in a small town know each other very well. They went to school together. They grew up together. They're often related to each other in some respect. A city is defined by strangers, by people who don't know each other well. People like, at a certain level, to come in or dislike coming into a city because they know they're going to interact with strangers. And so to me, the whole notion of strangers is really essential to the idea of cities. When it comes to the question of design, the real issue is, to what extent can you create an environment that is conducive to what you might consider healthful, polite interactions among strangers?
And what are some of the ways that cities do that? Do different cities do it differently?
Well, every city has a different character. It's a function of history. It's a function of the scale. It's often a function of the very deliberate decisions that have been taken through a city's history. If you look at a city like Boston, I lived there for about a dozen years. And people often said, well, you know, it's so easy to see Boston as being great and vital and urban because it's, you know, so dense and there's so many college students there and it's so historical. But the reality is there were decisions taken over the 400 plus year history of Boston that have made it the kind of physical forum for chance interactions among strangers.
Such as? Just a couple examples.
I'll give you a quick example. Boston made a very deliberate decision almost 50 years ago to reject federal funding for highways that would have run right through the heart of the city and invest that money instead in expansion of the public transit system there. Kansas City and Boston share a very important common trait, which is that there was a group of people who financed a lot of the early industries in both of those cities. And among the key industries that those financiers invested in were street railways. One of the reasons Kansas City used to have the street railway system, the streetcar system that it did, is because there were folks from Boston who invested in a system here. We abandoned that system a long time ago.
So it sounds like highways versus transit, you see that as kind of like a social interaction versus isolation scenario.
Oh, absolutely. And it's not necessarily that we conceived of ourselves and said, we don't want to interact with strangers anymore, therefore we're going to have highways. But the decision to invest at the level that we have in highways means we don't have those chance encounters on the street as frequently as people would in a city like Boston.
Because people don't stroll down the highway.
Well, you're in an enclosure. You're in a little vehicle that keeps you enclosed and insulated from the world around you. Whereas, you know, the example you gave at the beginning, being on the subway, you have no choice but to interact with strangers at every level, whether it's talking to someone or making eye contact with someone. I find it interesting. I think the whole notion of road rage is something that there's no way to understand the idea of road rage without understanding that that is something that is facilitated by the fact that people are in a physical moving object. if you weren't in a physical moving object, your likelihood of, you know, flipping someone the bird is probably somewhat more diminished if you were just walking past them on the street.
But yet the social norms in cities that do have this public transit is to avoid eye contact and to avoid interaction. And that's kind of why people are so surprised by these studies, that people's moods were consistently elevated. Even when they said, I'd prefer not to talk to strangers, when a stranger spoke to them, their moods were elevated. How do you explain that the city is, that these things are built to facilitate interaction, and yet the norm is to avoid eye contact, avoid interaction?
Well, you get into sort of customs and practices and beliefs and habits that people have. But the reality is, when people are brought into direct, regular, routine interaction with strangers, you either end up with a situation that's very chaotic by its nature, or over time you develop, as happens in cities, some rules and conventions. Avoiding direct eye contact is one of those. It's something that helps create a certain level of civility. If someone's literally sitting 4 feet away from you and is just burrowing their eyeballs into your forehead, that's obviously very disconcerting, right? And so the idea that you're going to have direct interaction with strangers on a frequent basis in a city, it's understood, it's given. But there are some rules and there are some habits that govern what can, you know, allow us to have a society and still be in the presence of hundreds, if not thousands, of people we don't know.
Well, we'll address how Kansas City and other American cities tend to view strangers in just a moment. But I'd like to introduce our second guest before we get too much further. Shannon Jackson, Associate Professor of Anthropology at UMKC. Good morning. Thanks
Good
for
morning.
Being here.
Good morning.
You're an urban anthropologist. What does that mean?
Well, it means that, I focus on urban contexts for my ethnographic data. Sometimes those urban contexts are small parts of a larger city.
So do the studies showing that people's moods are elevated by interactions with strangers surprise you, or is this what you would have expected to find?
No, I would have expected to find that. I think this is a phenomenon that, for example, sociologists have documented for a long time. When modern cities became ordinary sites of contact in the 19th century, early sociologists began to establish a kind of analytic vocabulary for strangers, because this is a phenomenon that became ordinary. It was not regarded as threatening.
Well, what's the conventional wisdom among urban anthropologists on the subject of strangers? Are there classical texts? Are there classical studies that we can reference here?
Actually, no. I don't think the urban stranger is something you find dealt with a lot by anthropologists. Much of the anthropological literature deals with how traditional societies deal with strangers, and it is very different. Smaller, more remote contexts will deal with strangers in a very different way than the modern urban setting.
Such as, how do they deal with them in the traditional settings?
Well, I like to think about a classic case study done by Keith Basso back in the 60s and 70s amongst the Apache, and he demonstrated that strangers in this group were dealt with through silence. Essentially, people would fall into total silence when they engaged strangers and wait essentially for that stranger to reveal him or herself over time before words were spoken.
Did the stranger tend to know that that was the expectation? I mean, if you're a stranger, you don't know anything. I could imagine sitting and waiting for a very long time to realize.
Yeah, it's very painful for strangers. Imagine the anthropologist himself encountered that, which is why he documented it.
Right. Yeah. Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM, streaming live at kcur.org. I'm Gina Kaufman, talking with city planner Daniel Serta and urban anthropologist Shannon Jackson about how cities bring strangers together or keep them apart. Later in the show, we'll hear from a coffee shop owner who has designated a community table for strangers who want to talk to each other over scones. We'll also want to hear from you. Where do you encounter strangers in Kansas City, and do you crave those interactions or avoid them? But for now, back to our resident experts. Daniel Serta, there's a concept in urban design known as the third space. It's a concept that seems really relevant to this discussion. So maybe you could explain that concept to us.
Sure. The idea of a third space is that, you know, in an industrial major teeming city with a booming economy, we spend most of our waking hours in two environments, the very private personal environment of home and the very busy, intense environment of work. And the notion of third place is the idea that there is really a need in urban society for sort of a mediating kind of space that allows you to sort of drift between those two environments in an informal, almost collegial kind of way, a way that you can create opportunities for socializing. So the classic third space is, in fact, something like a coffee shop or the tavern. I think we tend to think of those in popular culture as places that you go to unwind. I think there's a lot of tendency of thinking about, you know, getting together with friends. But if you really think about the nature of a third place in an urban environment, what you're really talking about is a place where you can have some degree of informal contact with people you don't know well. And that is part of what makes us gravitate to them, right? I mean, it's sort of like that classic image out of a sitcom or a movie where the stranger's sitting at the bar and there's just that chance sort of little glance or, you know, reaching across and, oh, excuse me, hi, oh, what's your name? You know, that sort of thing. Not to make it sound, you know, hackneyed or cliche, but the idea is really that, again, in terms of creating some sort of a stabilizing influence in what otherwise might be a very chaotic set of interactions, there's at least a sort of set upon and agreed norms when people go to a place like that. We have a certain level of expectations. When someone acts out against those expectations, for example, someone makes unwelcome advances towards you, you know, it's understood that there are sort of consequences and that will somehow be dealt with, whether it's by another patron at that establishment or by somebody that works there. So the idea really comes down to the notion that third places are essential to the vitality of cities. They're really the kinds of places that create a kind of social glue that both holds our society together and creates an opportunity for that informal socializing that's so essential to really just kind of our own psychological health.
Shannon Jackson, Daniel was just talking about that there are certain rules, unspoken rules, that govern how we behave in these kind of spaces. How do people learn those rules? How do you learn where that line is between being friendly to a stranger and encroaching on personal space?
There is a field in anthropology and cultural anthropology called proxemics. It became a bit outdated. I think it needs to be brought back, honestly. It is the study of how we manage spatial and social distance as simultaneous phenomena through movement, and how we essentially create this communicative landscape with our bodies through movement. And, you know, I'm fascinated by that sort of thing, that you can watch, you know, as another classic case study by William H. White that Daniel will be familiar with, The Social Life of Small Urban Spaces. And what's fun about that case study is you can watch strangers in their patterns of movement in relation to each other and in relation to the built environment in plazas in New York City and in other cities. And what you see is this very careful choreography that unfolds as bodies kind of move in relation to each other without colliding and without planning. It's all done in this kind of spontaneous movement where we will kind of move across space or move in relation to strangers in ways that create just the right distance without, you know, without the collision, without the awkward, you know, which side of the staircase are you moving up, which is not the case when you're interacting with people from other countries. So what you see there is immediately, if you come from a culture where you move on one side or the other, or you allow a certain distance for strangers that's different, there is a collision that occurs. You can encounter people from other cultures where that spatial distance is different, and there's an immediate discomfort. Americans are famous for our giant social bubbles and the need for everyone to be a certain distance from each other. And I joke with my students who always establish just the right distance from each other when they sit. They will even position their belongings, their backpacks and such, at just the right distance from someone else's backpack and will not, you know, violate that crucial bubble. And I liken it to, you know, when we're kids, say, take it all the way back to kindergarten, and you're being taught to queue or to line up, you know, that rule of creating an arm's length distance between yourself and the child in front of you. You learn how to create the right distance and to move in and through space and the built environment without, you know, too much too much entanglement with other children. And we get trained in that all the time. I think of primary school as being more about that than, you know, much else.
Do other cultures have this idea of personal space, like that phrase? Does that exist in other languages?
It exists. I would say it exists in every culture, but it's just the idea that social and spatial distance are themselves very different. I work in South Africa and spend time on the trains there, and commuting is a very different experience. My experience is that I am so close to people, there's really no possibility for polite socialization, you know, mostly because I can feel bodies kind of pressing in on me from every angle, and I have to kind of move in this careful way with this mob of bodies as they sort of, you know, dismount the train. It's a very different, and for an American, it's a kind of a panic moment. But you got to go with it.
Daniel, there was a reference in Shannon's discussion just now to interactions in the plaza, that's mm-hmm. where people's movements with respect to one another were observed by anthropologists. In the absence of, I mean, does Kansas City have an urban plaza other than, I mean, we have a place called the plaza, but...
Well, I've often told people the irony of the Country Club Plaza is that there is no plaza there, not in the classical Spanish sense, you know, and that entire concept of a plaza was essentially, it was both a legal and a physical planning precept for the Spanish colonies, that every colony had at its center the plaza that was fronted by the church and by the civic building of whatever nature that was, and it was the central locus of the street grid of those original places. We don't have a lot of places like that. I spent a dozen years in New England, and when I came back here in 2001, I remember going out and doing a very deliberate exercise in the Central Business District to try to see if I could find not a plaza per se, but an open public space that was really designed for that. And I walked and I walked and I walked. And I think the closest we had come by that point was a very deliberate attempt that I think most people would look at as either a mixed success or a mixed failure, which is Isles Davis Plaza, just north of City Hall. And it's a very large public space. It's a couple of city blocks. And what's so interesting about that, and this is the kind of question that Holly White, who Shannon referenced, was looking at, was the question of, you know, there were in New York City, as a result of some local ordinances, there was a requirement that buildings that in order to exceed certain zoning limits, they had to provide public plazas. And so the question that intrigued Holly White was the question of, well, how is it that some of those places seem very vital and really vibrant and others are just dead? They're places you wouldn't want to be. Is that a function of size? Is it a function of scale? Is it a function of the people who are there? Is it a function of what's nearby? And I would say in the case of Isles Davis Plaza, it's largely a function of the lack of active surrounding uses. I think the reality is for most people going even to City Hall, if you think about the reason that people go to City Hall, I mean, if you're going there for a public meeting or to interact with city agency, that's one thing. People are usually very deliberate and very directive in their purpose for going there. I don't think they often go there because they think of that outside civic space as being a primary destination. Now, on the other hand, we have a very interesting space right off the Country Club Plaza, Mill Creek Park, that seems to be the locus of every political protest that's happened over the last 20 or 30 years, which itself I think says a lot about Kansas City, because my impression of it is that part of the reason for that is that it's next to the Country Club Plaza, which is a very visible public space, but also because there's a very high volume of automobile traffic. And if you think about the protests, people are aiming their signs not at the media, not at each other, but at the passing cars. And so these things vary city to city, as I said before, in terms of the character and the nature of the places. We do have other gathering places as well, though, at the neighborhood scale and the smaller district scale, that I think you see that sort of what Jane Jacobs called sidewalk ballet, the kind of pattern of interactions and the ability of people to sort of weave themselves through and interact.
How would you characterize Kansas City's sidewalk ballet?
Well, it's interesting. I think of the places where it really happens, say, you know, Westport or downtown at certain times of the day or some of those neighborhood districts, it's not terribly remarkable compared to other cities. But I've often, and I don't mean this to sound off-putting anyway, but I've often found myself sort of tickled by being in environments where you can tell people aren't accustomed to having to be a dancer in that ballet. I don't go to the mall very often. Frankly, most people don't go to the mall very often anymore. But one of the last times I went to Oak Park Mall, for example, I was just stunned by how often people almost bumped into me. And my takeaway as somebody who lived in a very large, dense urban place for a long time is that most people, you know, in that context, aren't accustomed to having to navigate through large crowds of people. And certain basic conventions like, you know, that little rule you see on the escalators, you know, stand to the left, walk to the right sort of thing, they just don't prevail. They're not things that people intuitively necessarily understand. So I think in terms of back to your question, you know, where are those places? How do they function? How are they different? I think there are fewer of them here, to be frank. I think there's a lot of our public life, if you want to call it that, that doesn't necessarily play itself out on the street. Where it does, it's not typically all that different. I would say, I think if you were to measure these things, say, on a per capita basis, we probably have fewer large public gathering spaces than many other cities our size.
Cars and transit have come up a lot in this discussion already, and something that kind of interests me about this is parking lots. In downtown, there's a lot of talk about the need for more parking, but I wonder, with more parking structures, if people will increasingly sort of fall out of their cars and into their destinations without that kind of interaction.
Well, that's already happened, and it actually goes beyond that. If you think about it, the kinds of informal functions, places to eat, little hole-in-the-wall type places to eat, we actually have fewer of these. Kansas City was one of the places that pioneered the notion of a food court, for example. We had them first in the malls, and then they started showing up in office complexes. We did a little academic exercise about 10, 12 years ago I did with a group of students. We looked at Washington Square Park, which is immediately north of Crown Center, which is one of the most active urban places anywhere in Kansas City. And what was so interesting is that, you know, in the course of a regular day, you see very few people in Washington Square Park. I went out there one day and actually ate lunch in the park just to watch what was happening. And I thought, why are there so few? I mean, there's so many restaurants nearby. It's a green space. It was beautiful. It was sunny outside. Why are there so few people here? And as I happened to just glance off to sort of the northwest, I realized that one of the major office tenants nearby in the big office building just immediately to the north of Washington Square Park has an indoor cafeteria for their employees. So there were people eating right next to the park, but they were inside. And so, again, sometimes the physical design of those spaces, it's inadvertent. It's not deliberate, but it's inadvertent as an effort for people to have that kind of experience and just that sort of informal desire to go out and seek out that space where, again, you're going to have more contact with strangers. It's not going to be all the folks that you just work with. It's going to be people you don't know at all and people you don't know very well and people you might see every now and then if you do it on a regular basis.
Shannon, what do you think of this?
Well, I'm thinking about L.A. and, you know, as an extreme example of, you know, down, if you want to call it downtown L.A., is feels almost hostile to pedestrians. Mm-hmm. That much of what you encounter, you know, in your sidewalk experience is a dumb wall or a glass wall. And so my last trip there, I was surprised to discover that much of the social life unfolds on rooftops. You know, there's mm-hmm. this alternate universe on rooftops.
Yeah.
Well, Central Standard is going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll meet with a coffee shop owner who sets up the tables in his cafe with an eye toward bringing strangers together. We'll hear his story and we'll want to hear yours. Call us at 816-235-2888 to tell us about your memorable interactions with strangers. That and more after the break. I'm Gina Kaufman.
People are strange when you're a stranger. Faces look ugly when you're alone. Women seem wicked when you're unwanted. Streets are uneven when you're down, when you're strange. Faces come out of the rain when you're strange. No one remembers your name.
Good morning and welcome back to Central Standard. No strangers in here. That's the Doors. We're learning about the role of strangers in our lives and our communities. We know we're not supposed to accept candy from them, but talking to them is okay, right? We've been hearing from a city design expert and an urban anthropologist to find out where Kansas Cityans cross paths with total strangers. We'll get back to that conversation in a moment, but now please welcome Greg Tugman to the conversation. He runs Great Day Cafe in downtown Overland Park. Hi, Greg. Thanks for joining us.
It's an honor.
Well, baristas are kind of the ultimate stranger talkers, don't you think? I mean, if you don't strike that right balance of being friendly without overstepping boundaries, the tip jar is going to be awfully empty at the end of the day.
Yeah, tipping is actually, I think, the most direct form of charity, because most people that work in the industry, single moms and students, so tip well out there, folks.
So what are some of the rules of thumb for knowing which side of that fine line you're on when you're interacting with strangers?
Well, it's a people industry. When you serve food, you want to make people feel, at least our philosophy is make them feel comfortable. We actually have kind of the very same decor as we used to have in our house, which is the same sort of whimsical art, which makes us feel like we're at home, and people respond accordingly, or they don't. Sometimes people retract from it because maybe they prefer a more sterile environment. But in general, you got to get people feeling comfortable so that if they enjoy the dining experience, you know, they come back.
In your experience, how are friendly interactions with strangers different from similar kinds of interactions with friends and family?
Well, first of all, you don't friends and family know the rules when they get together. They already know who everybody is, and it's usually a planned event, a birthday, a holiday, or whatever. Strangers just coming through the door because they like the look of it or they like the menu on the window. The Great Day Cafe is pretty unique on all those kind of levels. It's not a sports bar. It's not a franchise chain box store restaurant. So I think automatically we have a filtering effect taking place where people come through the doors because they kind of already know what they're getting themselves into. So I think that we're already in an advantage of that. And if our staff is actually very motivated, we pay them a working wage or for the industry anyway, and they're very happy. And I think that general, when you hear everybody laughing and joking behind the counter while they're making your food, it kind of like it becomes sort of viral throughout the cafe. And there's just lots of laughter and excited. You can hear the energy level and the way people are talking to each other.
So you have this community table at your cafe. What inspired you to do that?
Well, it had to do with we put a stage in. Originally, I started out as the cook and the accountant. And the next thing you know, I started playing clarinet, flute, and guitar, which became a ukulele. Ukuleles are cuter and more personal. And we had to make a little room for a stage, and we had to combine some of the tables. And my wife came up with an idea that every friend begins as a stranger. And it's a central table right in the middle of the cafe with the sign that says that. And we have people that actually aim directly for that table, or conversely, people who try to avoid sitting at that table. When we're crowded, you have no choice but to sit at that table, and it's fun to watch. I can see them from the stage. Sometimes they keep their bubbles, and you can watch people reach across or next door and start interacting. And it usually, people respond. They know what they're going to get themselves into when they sit at that table, and it's marvelous to watch.
Is this the kind of interaction that attracted you to this line of work? I learned on your website that you actually used to be a corporate finance executive. That must have been a very different work environment.
It's a speckled career. Yeah, I've been there. I actually worked in the Kansas governor's office, staffed Bob Dole, Nancy Kassebaum. I've done all of that, and one thing led to another. And when we got corporate downsized, we said, well, do we want to continue this game, or what do we really want to do? And I've always been attracted to the funky, cool cafes, partly because you meet interesting people there. And both my wife and I thought this is a worthy goal, and we actually set out to create a place worth going to. One of our deliberate decisions was not to have any television sets. Because I've always noticed, even if the sound is off and you're talking to somebody, you watch people's eyes. They kind of wander up to the TV and back down again, up and down again. And I think you're losing, 5% of the communication that could have been there otherwise. And of course, texting. How many times have you been to a restaurant where you see couples sitting across from each other just texting throughout the whole meal.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't tell people not to do that, but I think that the Great Day Cafe's been very successful in it kind of breaks that whole space up. There's lots of funny stuff going on, people laughing. There's this guy in the corner playing a clarinet. Mozart or Benny Goodman, could you never know. But it breaks up people's normal expectations of how to behave. And the next thing you know, they might be acting outside of the typical social box that they usually see themselves in.
Have you had a memorable conversation with a stranger that changed you or maybe just changed your day for the better?
Oh, happens every day. I know several people who've met at the table, and usually, you know, 6 degrees of separation, they'll find out that they went to the same school or had the same teacher or some of the same experiences. But what also happens is that people walk directly up to me. I could be playing the flute, and they walk right up to me and start talking to me. And I'll stop, of course, and start talking to them. And that shows you that they're already feeling accessible. I digress a little bit, but I used to wear sunglasses because it was like, oh, that looks like kind of a cool musician. But then I realized if I took the sunglasses off, what would happen? And people approach you more. You look more like a musician with them on, but when you take them off, you look up and they're looking at you, and then the next thing you know, they come towards you and they strike up a conversation.
Well, Greg, thank you. It's been so much fun talking to you, and we'll be interested in your ongoing experiments and communal tables and such in downtown Overland Park. Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
And now let's get back to our resident urban anthropologist and city planner, Daniel Serta and Shannon Jackson. We'd like to hear from you out there as well. Where do you encounter strangers in Kansas City? And do you crave those interactions or do you avoid them? 816-235-2888 is the number to call. That's 816-235-2888. You can also email centralstandard@kcur.org. And we've heard from Gabby, who writes, I met one of my best friends as a stranger on the bus. We both used to catch every morning. She was hysterical and soon became the highlight of my morning. Daniel Serta, what are your thoughts about bus rides as possible third spaces?
Well, I don't know that I would go as far as calling them the third spaces, but one of the things you learn if you spend any amount of time using public transit is that there are the regular riders, and they know the driver, and the driver knows them. And other riders wonder, well, where's Jerry today? He wasn't at the stop. I wonder if he's not feeling well. I wonder what's going on. And so that Greg referred to this, the idea of, you know, every friend at one point was a stranger, and that's also referenced in that message. There is a breaking down of that barrier, the point where eye contact is no longer rude. It's something that's more essential to creating sort of a social bond between people. As a planner and a designer, the real question is, well, how do you facilitate that? And I think, you know, the general line of thought that's emerged among a lot of urban designers over the last 30, 40 years or so is that it's really a function of the frequency in which we can have those interactions. How often can you find that sort of space where it's comfortable and that casual interaction that happens often enough that you start to break down that wall a little bit.
Well, let's go ahead and talk to one of our callers about this stuff. We've got Pam in Overland Park on the line. Hi, Pam.
Hi. Great conversation. Having lived around the world and having lived in New York City and then coming out here, I noticed that there was a real absence of the space embracing us. And at public space, I love rapping with strangers, and I love finding out lots of information from people that I would never, and you know, in my daily routine, talk to. My concern is this: there are places like Town Center, which has nothing to do with the town and nothing to do with the center. Now, it's always really disturbed me that they create these artificially, really cold spaces and then name them some warm, fuzzy name. And just wanted some thoughts about that, because I really think that there's an opportunity here, like the Crossroads, that is not a warm, fuzzy space where you feel like you can talk to people and interact with people. There's no trees, there's no benches, you know, and the city would really benefit from creating more of that. I mean, there are reasons why people go to the Nelson, because of the courtyard, it's a very embracing space. So I'd really, and also you mentioned Mill Creek, and the plaza used to be this, the Country Club Plaza. I don't think it's a warm, fuzzy space anymore that's inviting, except for the flowers. So I just would love it if you would address this issue more in terms of why these false names and why you would, you know, anyway, go ahead.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that call, Pam. And I'll be curious to hear what Daniel Serta has to say about some of this.
Well, a quick thought about that is, you know, the marketing of places is actually an essential aspect of this. And there's a lot of writing about this because there's the very deliberate, almost corporate type marketing and labeling of places. But there's also a lot of very informal naming of places that goes on. You think about every neighborhood has some level of identity. Sometimes those identities are really purely fictitious, but people who live there and are familiar with the area have a sense of what the boundaries are, what the edges are, what the character of the place is. So there's more of an organic and there's sometimes kind of an artificial. I think what's interesting, part of what's revealed in the column, there was a lot there, but is, you know, it comes down to a basic element of design. Shannon referenced this earlier. She was talking about Los Angeles, downtown Los Angeles, and these long blank walls. Many people stopped and thought about it. You thought about the most interesting, most vital parts of cities you've ever been in, what Alan Jacobs, an urban designer, calls the great street. What defines a great street or a great urban space is often the variety and diversity and the scale of uses along that street. It's not just that there are a lot of people there. It's that there are these little hole-in-the-wall places that you could drop in, and there's the cafe, and there's the stranger table that Greg was talking about in that one location. But there's also a whole little cacophony of other little places that draw people there, and you have that, again, frequent intermingling of different people that creates that sidewalk ballet that I referenced earlier. What happened back in the 1950s and 1960s is we started building and rebuilding a lot of our downtowns on a really massive scale. Probably the most egregious example of this in Kansas City, if you think about it, is you look at the exterior of the original Bartle Hall. I mean, I've heard people describe that as the Darth Vader of downtown. It's just nothing but black and gray and steel. And there's literally, you can't see in, you can't see what's there. That was an environment that was created for the experience within, right? Hundreds and thousands of people go to the home shows at the convention center, for example, but nobody goes there to see what's going on out on the street. And so it's not to say that's right or wrong. It's just a different kind of experience and an experience of a city where all of those uses sort of spill out onto the street, both in terms of the people and the activities and literally the vending, whether it's food or fruit or flowers or whatever the case is. It just creates a very different kind of physical environment and opportunity for people to interact with strangers.
And Pam referenced benches. Do you think that there are places in Kansas City where benches, that's something very simple, could increase that possibility?
Oh, they absolutely could, because more often than not, there are no benches. There are no places to sit. Holly White, who Shannon referenced earlier, came up with the basic axiom of urban design, which is so commonsensical that it sounds like a farce, and that was that people will sit where there are places to sit. And we often don't have places to sit.
We actually took three park benches, and our staff, which are all artists and musicians, painted those hand-painted those medges. They're wonderful, and they're sitting right outside our cafe. And we're right next to a small clock tower plaza, but there's very limited seating, and there are people sitting on those benches. In fact, we put a video up of, you know, my wife did a fast-action video of people that come sit down and take pictures. There's high school graduation pictures, wedding pictures. And we did that and the art on the benches kind of invites people to come sit down. We've been trying to get the Downtown Merchants Association to, you know, that would make, instead of having to build statues and fountains like the plaza, if everybody had like hand-painted benches, that would kind of unify, give people an opportunity to wander around, explore, you know, the city of 50 benches. There's 50 things to walk around and look at. That's still a work in progress.
Well, and that's interesting to me that you just took it upon yourself to put benches out. Do the people who sit down have to be customers?
No, they're sitting outside along the street. And as I say, they're beautiful. Unfortunately, the weather's been kind of hard on them, but it just says, come, you know, it's inviting. Come sit down, take a rest for a spell. You know, enjoy the view.
Shannon Jackson, what are your thoughts about this?
Well, I'm reflecting back on your caller's use of the term center. And I think that's a very important category to revisit, because in some respects, I think of center in relation to the human body. And a lot of our measure of good space is space that is itself body-centered. And body-centered space is one that acknowledges the way the human body actually takes possession of space. She also used the term embrace, right? That, you know, we use the metaphor of embrace to wrap our arms around space, and to have it return the embrace essentially is to collapse the relationship between body and space as if they are one and the same. So the center of the body is the heart. It's not the geographic center or the Cartesian center. It's the center because it's a place where we actually can feel the insides of our body or the inside of our body in a kind of regular in the regular beat of the heart. And we want the heart of a city also to kind of occupy a similar relationship, where even if it's a fountain or a bench or something, that anchors a relationship that we can possess. So it's a bodily form of possession of space, and space then itself acknowledges us as having bodies. We have bodies that need to sit, that need to relax. We have bodies that obviously need to open onto each other.
Open onto each other.
The idea of encountering strangers is that, you know, you are a body that orients between a front and a back. You have a front and a back, and your front is the place whereby you do most of your communicating. And so you need spaces that enable bodies to kind of, you know, engage each other from one front to another. So if a bench facilitates two people sitting back to back, it's not going to work, to kind of create that positive zone or third space between strangers. It has to be front to front. A staircase can do that. Any kind of space whereby we are regularly encountering each other, you know, in that front to front orientation.
Two quick reactions to that. One is Holly White was really, in the Street Life Project in New York, was really fascinated by how people oriented themselves to each other in the places where you could sit. And one of his recommendations was that one of the features, sitting features, that makes places most vital is the movable chair, because people can orient them. And he even has a little video sequence where he shows people are moving chairs about and moving chairs about and moving chairs about. Inevitably, they end up in the same position that they started from. People like to drag chairs around, but you end up with people basically facing each other and wanting to interact in the way that Shannon was describing. The other thing I would say really quickly is that this question of, well, why don't we do that? I mean, it seems so commonsensical. He also had an answer for, which was that an immense amount of energy and time is spent in urban spaces worrying about the possibility that you don't want to put a bench out because someone who's undesirable might actually sit down there, somebody who's not a paying customer, somebody who's a nuisance to others. And Holly White's answer to that was to say that if we invested the same level of energy in facilitating people's ability to sit as we do in discouraging them, then we might actually create spaces that are very vital and active.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM, streaming live at kcur.org. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is Central Standard, and we're talking with Shannon Jackson, Daniel Serta, and Greg Tugman about strangers and what Kansas City does and doesn't do to bring us into contact with these wonderful beings, these strangers who can brighten up our day. We have a bunch of callers, and I want to get to them. If you want to join this conversation, hurry up at 816-235-2888. We've got Phil and Rosedale on the line.
Howdy. There were a few places I've noticed that do work. West 39th Avenue with all the little shops and restaurants. I see people walking there and eventually become regulars talking to each other. I noticed that art worked well for this sort of thing, too. I remember recently Ward Parkway had a grocery store can sculpture exhibit up and down the side, and people were stopping. Again, the excuse was the sculpture, but people would stop and talk to each other and engage in conversation, obviously strangers. I have a hobby where I do what they call guerrilla gardening, where you pick a public space that's neglected and plant a few flowers. Boy, there is nothing. People feel completely free to come up and talk to you when they find you in that kind of situation. And I wanted to remind, if there's any older listeners, I'm 67. There was briefly a fabulous meeting place in Kansas City on the south lawn of the Nelson Atkins Museum in the late 60s, early 70s. Where people congregated regularly, especially on the weekends, but every day of the week.
All right.
afternoon.
I want to get our guests' reactions to this call so that we can make sure we get that in. Daniel?
Well, 39th Avenue is the epitome of that small-scale, very fine-grained kind of urban place where there's just that constant sidewalk ballet and really interesting energy among strangers.
Anyone else want to weigh in on that?
I want to say that one of the things that makes a public plaza public is if you have local merchants, locally owned shops and stores. My critique of the town centers is they're all chain concept stores. Good food, clean environment, but you're not going to find the owner anywhere within 1,000 miles of that. And even though you might get a decent plate of food, you lose some of that connection that makes it a community. In downtown Overland Park, we're all locally owned merchants.
All right, let's hear from Will in Overland Park.
Hi, I just got back from a small town in Italy, and when we first went over there, we were all strangers, and where we really started to meet people was along those little streets and the plazas, those public areas. And if you looked at where we started to know the shop owners and everything, they were all along those small streets, or the main street, the Corso, or the public plazas. And that's where we really start to meet people. And here in KC, there's a few places like Westport, something like that, where I get the same sense, but the defensible space is so much bigger here, with lawns, and you get in your car and you drive there, where we would just walk out of our apartment and be on the street, and we go see all those regular people. And over time, we start to meet them and become friends with them.
Hey, Daniel, when would you say that American and European cities sort of diverged in their planning that causes Will to notice this difference in city structure and in interaction?
It was right after World War II. We had the federal government pour massive resources into urban renewal, which gave cities the opportunity to literally scrub away places that today we would probably look at as being very diverse and architecturally really stunning. But at the time, they were seen as sort of tawdry, questionable, dicey kinds of places to be. There were a few of those places that were saved. The North End in Boston, for example, planners wanted to wipe it off the face of the earth. That's part of what starts out Jane Jacobs in her book, The Death and Life of Great American Cities. She says, this is an attack on current city planning. You take the North End, the average city planner today thinks it is an awful place. But if you go there, it is the vital definition of what an urban city is about because of those interactions between strangers.
Well, I think it's important to acknowledge that Kansas City has a unique history that goes up, even earlier, that essentially J.C. Nichols, part of his planning vision was that the automobile was an organic component of moral community, that the car was a member of the family, and he began to actually experiment with large-scale planning here in ways other cities had not yet done in the early 20th century, prior to, World War II. He was laying the groundwork for a city designed for the automobile. Why parking garages are such an organic component of the plaza, as in many respects, you can't even recognize where the parking garage begins and the rest of the building ends. The same way with his houses. The garage became a kind of, seamless extension of the house itself. The car had a room of its own, like a member of the family.
Shannon, do you like interacting with strangers?
Well, I'm one of these reserved bookie academics and tend to have my nose in a book a lot. But I would say, yes, I do. I appreciate, people being nice to me. That way I can break the ice because I'm not generally good at doing it first.
Daniel, what about you?
I agree with you, the initial observation, that idea of uplift. To me, there's just something about engaging in a civic sense with people that you don't know and having the opportunity for those informal interactions. But I'll admit, I'm a very family-centered person. I've got kids and I have my domestic life too. So being able to transition between those two different spheres sometimes I think is an advantage of a place like Kansas City.
Where in Kansas City do you do that?
To you mean home life or
the in between?
The in between. Well, the in between. It's a variety of places. I'm doing a lot of professional work right now in downtown Kansas City, Kansas, and getting to reno that place in a way that it's changed a lot since 20 years ago when I spent some amount of time there. I sort of find the opportunity where it presents itself.
We've run out of time for today's conversation. Thanks so much to Daniel Serta, Shannon Jackson, and Greg Tugman for being here. Tomorrow we'll hear from poet Glenn North about the community he's built around the spoken word. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned for Up to Date next.